eulogies. My eulogy for my mother needed its own eulogy. But my self-deprecation is just another form of narcissism, right? What kind of ass apologizes for his eulogy? I'm a magician fucking up his act. And now I've gone public with my embarrassment. As my dead mother shouts, "I can see your fake thumb." Chapter 121, Psalm of Myself. At my mother's funeral, a stranger said, "It hurts more to lose your mother than your father." At first, I scoffed. "Oh, you never had the honor of meeting my mom. She was army ant intense." And yet, weeks after her funeral, I'm still swarmed by her memory's teeth. I mean, it was easy to love my father. He always sought to appease. He was addicted to surrendering. He harmed nobody. I don't think he had one enemy. But my mom, she waged war on everything that moved. She indicted and convicted before she accused. She mocked oxygen and scolded gravity. And yes, I'm aware of how much I resemble her. I'm the child with all of her vanity and rage. I'm the actor who needs and needs to take the stage and with tender spite seek to reassemble her. But have I created her in my image? Am I playing God? She belonged to herself and not to me. She birthed me, not the other way around. She is my mortal deity. To emulate her, I'll be arrogant, angry, beautiful, and odd. Chapter 122, Hunger Games. I crave grief for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Sweet grief, salted grief. I want so much to swallow you whole. I'm a damn sinner who can only be saved by your fingers. Hurry. Place the sacred grief on my tongue and consecrate breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Or maybe not. I wish I were slimmer and more disciplined, a secular monk. But I lust, lust, and lust. I'm a sinner who seeds, threshes, harvests, feasts, and shivers. Forgive me, condemn me. I need flesh and blood and grief at each breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I want to want too much. I know what hinders and troubles you, but join me in this flood. Look at me. I'm your beloved sinner. Sit with me, please. Let's talk. Please linger. Let's touch and eat everything that we touch. Let us stay through breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Let's become each other's favorite sinner. Chapter 123, Communal. 13 months after my mother died, my sister texted me that her refrigerator had finally given up. "It's leaking everywhere," she texted. We unplugged it, and all the food is in plastic coolers with ice. That dead refrigerator was in the kitchen of my childhood home on the reservation. Our family home. Then our mother's home after our father died, and now my sister and niece's home. I remembered that I bought the refrigerator maybe 10 or 12 years earlier, not long after my father had died. My sisters live on low-paying jobs and disability checks. They long ago destroyed their credit ratings, so they can't buy a refrigerator all at once or in monthly payments. Send me the dimensions of the old fridge, I texted back to my sister, and I will order you a new one from Sears. A few moments later, my sister texted, 64 inches high, 29 inches wide, 31 inches deep. I scanned the Sears website for good deals on fridges, for one that would fit the space and had an ice maker. I was goofily happy to think of an ice-making refrigerator in my childhood home. It felt like an earned extravagance. But ice-making fridges cost over $1,000. I could have afforded that, but I didn't want to spend that much money. I've often had to financially rescue my siblings and parents over the years. I resent it sometimes, being the family hero, but I deal with my resentment by setting limits. So I bought Nemana that cost only $600, and I texted my sister and suggested she get some cousin to pick it up from Sears in Spokane, otherwise it would cost me another $200 to have it delivered to the reservation. Okay, my sister texted, can you send me gas money for whoever picks it up? Okay, I texted, and transferred cash to her bank account. There's money for all of you. Split it evenly and pay somebody to get the fridge. A week later, my sister texted me a photo of the new refrigerator looking rather Darth Vader-esque, wedged into the space where the old fridge had been. Thank you, my sister texted. Everything cold is cold. And everything frozen is frozen. I realized the new fridge resembled a new coffin or a large black tombstone. I realized that I'd never have to send emergency cash to my dead mother ever again. I'd never have to rescue her from her poor financial decisions, from the poverty she'd created for herself, and for the poverty forced upon her. But I know I will be rescuing my siblings until all of them are dead, or until I'm dead. My doctor ordered me to only eat food that grows or walks, my sister texted me a few days later. Healthy food is so expensive. I'll send you some greens to buy greens, I texted her. Some lettuce to buy lettuce so you can become a skinny res rabbit. Except I typed rabbi instead of rabbit, a funny mistake. Can a woman be a rabbi? My sister texted me back with a smiling emoji. Yes, I texted back. That's one of the coolest things about Jewish cultures. Women can be spiritual leaders. A woman was president of Israel. I think mom was like a rabbi, my sister texted. Ha! I texted back. But remember, she lost by 20 votes when she ran for tribal council. It was a close election. I thought of Hillary Clinton and her close loss to Donald Trump. Our tribe survived the man who defeated our mother. I don't know if our country will survive Trump. I looked up rabbi online, my sister said. It means teacher. Was our mother a teacher? Was she holy? I think so. I'm not sure. Maybe. So I texted her old cell phone. I don't know if her number had already been assigned in the months since her death. I didn't know who might receive my text. So, in not knowing its destination, it felt like a prayer. How sacred were you? I texted my mother's ghost. I am still waiting for a response. Chapter 124. Your Theology or Mine. 371 days after my mother's death, after enduring what can only be described as the worst year of my adult life, after maternal loss and forest fires and uranium radiation and brain surgery and seizures and more forest fires, and after a fevered and flawed and grief-driven study of family and tribal history, I realize that I am equally a child of Jesuit and Salish cultures. I might be an atheist, driven more by my reaction to the politics of religion than its practical theology, but I am also the progeny of the mystical Jesus and the mystical salmon. I would argue that Jesus is made of salmon, and each salmon is made of many parts of Jesus. And yes, I know those are contradictory thoughts for an atheist to express. So what? If you believers want to corner me, if you force me to choose the word, then I am going to choose only one word. And that one word is going to be a verb. And that one verb will be return. For I am always compelled to return, return, return to my place of birth, to my reservation, to my unfinished childhood home, and ultimately to my mother, my ultimate salmon. I return to her, my mother, who in these pages dies and dies and dies and is continually reborn. Chapter 125. Review, Reprise, Revision. At some point in my childhood, in my early teens, my mother, Lillian, told me the most painful secret of her life. I have repeated this conversation in my head many times over the years. I repeat it in this book. I can't help but repeat it. I repeat the same words, sentences, and paragraphs. That's what happens. Great pain is repetitive. Grief is repetitive. And maybe this repetition can become a chant inside a healing ceremony. Junior, she said, I am the daughter of a rape. What? I asked, unsure that I'd heard her correctly. A man raped my mother, and she got pregnant with me because of it. Who was the rapist? My mother, Lillian, said his name. He was a man who died years earlier. I'd never known him, but I knew his children, and went to the tribal school with his grandchildren. They were among the tallest kids on the reservation. Unlike my siblings and parents, I was tall, too. I'd always wondered why I was so much taller than the rest of my family, why I was darker. I'd sometimes worried that perhaps I wasn't my father's biological child. But I have the same widow's peak cowlick, a rebellious lock of black hair that defies styling, as my father. My biological older brother and my younger twin sisters have that cowlick, too. Plus, as I've aged from a skinny, dark kid into a chubby, paler man, having lived in sunless Seattle for 23 years, I have come to strongly resemble my father and my siblings, but not in height. The man who raped your mother, I said. Your father? He's not my father, my mother said. She was angry. My father is James Cox, the man who raised me. I was always afraid of her anger. Everybody was afraid of Lillian's anger. We were always trying to mollify her. I'm sorry, I said. The rapist? Was he tall? My mother immediately understood what I was asking. Yes, she said. That's where you get your height. I didn't ask my mother anything else. I didn't have the emotional vocabulary. And I'm not sure she had the emotional vocabulary either. Rape was common on my reservation, but it was rarely discussed and never prosecuted. Why not? I would guess it has something to do with the strict social rules of a tribe. White folks love to think that Native American culture is liberal, but it is actually repressive. Indians are quick to socially judge one another, and even quicker to publicly condemn and ostracize. I wouldn't realize it until I read more widely in college. But living on an Indian reservation was like living inside an Edith Wharton novel. Disruption was not tolerated. And I think I know the source of intolerance. For thousands of years, we Spokane had endured and enjoyed subsistence lives. We lived communally. Every member of the tribe had a job. And each job was vital. So, inside a subsistence culture, a socially disruptive tribal member would have been mortally dangerous to everybody else. But there is a logical problem with that, isn't there? First of all, we were living in the 20th century and not the 14th or 15th. And if that were still true, if socially disruptive tribal members were traditionally punished no matter the century, then wouldn't it make more sense for the tribe to ostracize and even expel rapists? Well, not if the rapist was a culturally significant figure. Not if the rapist, however economically poor, was socially rich and powerful. Not if the rapist could put on an eagle feather headdress and make a beautiful and powerful entrance into the powwow arena. And what would happen inside a small tribe if every minor or major crime, if every small or large transgression was made public? What if we natives practiced that same kind of justice inside our own communities as the justice that we demand from white society? Of course, centuries of genocidal acts by white Americans have certainly helped teach us natives how to commit genocidal acts against one another. But at what point do we Native American victims start demanding more justice and freedom from our Native American oppressors? And what happens if those indigenous oppressors happen to be our parents? For over three decades, I believed that one of my biological grandfathers was a rapist. I thought I was the grandson of rape. But in July 2016, just over a year after my mother died, I had a telephone conversation with my sister Arlene. We were discussing our half-sister Mary and her convoluted parentage. I wanted to get the details correct for this memoir. Mary was the child of a rape, my sister said. Wait, I said, you mean Mom was the child of a rape? No, she said. Mom was the child of an affair. No, I said, Mom told me she was the child of a rape. She never told me that. Who did she say she was raped by? I gave her the name of the accused rapist. No, my sister said. Mom's mom was having an affair with him, and they got pregnant. I laughed. I didn't mean to laugh. It wasn't funny. But its awful seriousness is what made it hilarious. Jesus, I'd believed yet another one of my mother's fabrications, or wait. Maybe my sister had been fooled again by our mother, or maybe she told us two different lies. Would our mother lie about rape? And you know what's really messed up? My sister said. What? I asked, wondering what could possibly be worse than lying about rape. You want to know what our cheating grandma and our cheating boyfriend did? What? Well, my sister said, do you know the name of the cheater's wife? I said her last name. Yeah, that's it, my sister said. But do you know what her first name was? No, I said. Guess? Tell me. No, guess? I have no idea. Okay, my sister said. Just think about it. What's the worst thing a husband and his affair snag could name their adultery kid? I thought about it. And then I suddenly understood. Oh, shit, I said. They named Mom after the wife? Yep. Mom is Lillian. That poor wife was also Lillian. I threw my cell phone on the couch and walked away. I paced. Was this completely fucked up story just another one of my mother's grandiose falsehoods? But wait, 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 I kept thinking. What if my mother was telling the truth about some of it? What if it was the partial truth? She'd always been such a damaged person, and that damage had to have been inflicted by somebody. So what if my mother lied about the specific details of her pain, but was always emotionally honest about the volume of her suffering? If it's fiction, then it better be true. And then I remembered the original topic of my conversation with my sister, so I picked my phone back up and laughed and cursed while my sister laughed and cursed. So who raped Mom, I asked. Who raped Lillian II and got her pregnant with our sister? My sister then told me an even more awful story. When my mother was rapidly becoming a rebellious teen, her parents sent her to Sacramento to live with her older sister and her husband, who'd been relocated to Northern California as part of the Indian Relocation Act of 1956. Relocation was meant to educate Indians, give them new life and job skills, and help them assimilate into mainstream culture. And it accomplished all of that, while also damaging and destroying cultural bonds among thousands of Indians and their ancestral homelands and cultures. Jesus, I said, Mom told me she was relocated, but she always said she traveled alone to Sacramento, got off the bus downtown, had a bowl of soup, and caught the next bus back home to Spokane. Nope, my sister said. She lived there for a few months with her big sister and big sister's first husband. I wanted to hang up the phone. So the husband raped Mom, I said. Yes, my sister said. So Mary is the child of a rape. Yes. So Mary is our mother's daughter and her niece. I hadn't thought about that, my sister said, but you're right. And Mary is our half-sister and our half-first cousin, too. Something like that, my sister said. How come I've never heard any of this before? Come on, Junior, my sister said. You haven't lived on the res in 36 years. So many stories and secrets get told. Time goes by. Time goes by. My sister was telling the truth. I am disconnected from my tribe. By my choice. And yes, I am disconnected from my immediate family, too. By my choice. I have traveled the world. My sister has lived in the same house for 44 years. Man, I said, Mom was so full of shit. What are we supposed to believe? Where did all that bullshit come from? What are we supposed to do with all the bullshit? Well, my sister said, you got famous on that bullshit. And we laughed. Chapter 126. The Widow's Son's Lament. My mother and I'd held each other hostage for 36 years. But then my dad died, and Mom and I were too damn exhausted to be jailers anymore. We untied old knots and unlocked cell doors in tandem and walked free in separate directions. Neither of us demanded a ransom. She remained on the reservation, and I took refuge in the city. We still phone gossiped about friends and family. I sent her money to pay past due bills from power and satellite companies. We met in person a few times a year. We laughed too loudly in public places. We never mentioned the old pain and fear. We somehow achieved homeostasis. We didn't speak of forgiveness. We didn't play that ruse. No, we were mother and son, and we'd declared a truce. Chapter 127. Physics. I want to reverse this earth and give birth to my mother, because I do not believe that she was ever adored. I want to mother the mother who often did not mother me. I was mothered and adored by mothers not my own, and learned how to be adoring by being adored. So if I adore my mother after giving birth to this new version of her, will she change history and become one who openly and freely adores her daughters and sons? I don't know. I don't know if it's possible in any potential world. But build me a time machine, and I'll give this shit a whirl. Chapter 128. Spring Cleaning. If attics are the eggs, then steamer trunks are the yolks. 13 years after my father died, and 13 months after my mother's death, I open my father's steamer trunk, his chest egg, and find toy guns, basketball cards, and cigar smoke. Evoke! Evoke! My father designed this strange collection with my sons in mind. My glorious boys are part egg and part yolk. But I think that he meant it as a joke, affectionate and unkind, because he knew that I love basketball but hate guns and smoke. Suddenly choked, blind, and broken open like an egg and spilled like a yolk, I mourn my mother. I mourn my father. I sometimes wear his coat, an outdated big collar consign that I realize also smells of toy guns, basketball cards, and cigar smoke. I want my grief to be baroque, but damn it, it's as simply designed as an egg and its yolk, and as unrefined as a chest heavy with guns and mothers and hoops and smoke. Chapter 129, Discourse. My friend John Cyrus is a Colville Indian singer, drummer, and Dartmouth graduate currently working to protect the Upper Columbia and Spokane Rivers. An Ivy League Indian, and a powwow Indian, and a wild salmon restoration champion can easily be the same person. Yes, a native can be highly educated, live in the city, and be the guy you call when you need a beautiful prayer and a hand-drum honor song. I often get asked, "Sherman, how do the indigenous live in two worlds? How is it possible?" And I'm all, "Shit, I code switch 18 times before I drink my first cup of coffee." Don't you white folks understand that Indians turn everything we do into something Indian? That's how we reverse colonialism, by taking back most of the good things that were stolen from us and grabbing some of your good things too. And when like-minded Indians get together, oh man, you get some classical drama. I love my friend John Cyrus like Pythias loved Damon. Yeah, that's right. I just claimed two mythical Greek dudes as my own. I compared their love to my love for another Indian man. You call that assimilation? I say maybe John and I will write a powwow song about Pythias and Damon. Philia, Philia, way Ohio. Philia, Philia, way Ohio. This Indian is my brother. He's my brother, and I love him so. I love him so. Aho! John is also a very handsome dude. When he met my late mother-in-law for the first time, she turned to her daughter, Diane, my wife, and asked, "How come you didn't marry John?" I met John at the same academic camp for Indian kids where I met Diane. John was mentoring high school kids from his reservation. Diane was running the whole thing. And I was a judge for the essay competition. Yes, John, Diane, and I were born into the clan of indigenous brainiacs. What you gotta say about that? John was one of the Indian guys, along with a few high school kids, who gave me the courage to ask Diane for a first date. John also knew my mother. "I was thinking about the times we'd be at your readings," John texted. "And your mom was always asking me to keep you from cussing." "Ha, ha, ha," I texted back. "I am profane, but nearly always for specific reasons. My profanity has an aesthetic. And Indians in general have dirty mouths. But those same privately filthy Indians will turn into warriors of decorum in public venues, especially when white folks are in the audience. I think many Indians consciously and subconsciously seek the approval of white folks. As a colonized people, we tend to perform our Indianness as a way of asserting our identities. These performances can be full of sovereign pride and codependent groveling at the same time from the same person. I want to get the attention of white folks too, but I enjoy positive and negative reactions. I am the author of one of the most banned and challenged books in American history, and that makes me giddy with joy. But all in all, I am most gleeful about inciting the wrath of other Indians. "You were bullied as a kid by your own tribe," my therapist once said, "so it's not surprising you'd strongly react to bullying or what you think feels like bullying. It's not surprising you fight back, that you enjoy fighting back, especially against other Indians. Being bullied can turn you into a bully, I said to my therapist. Yes, she said. That stuff that you hate in others is often the stuff you hate in yourself. But perhaps you can learn something about yourself when this happens. When you are angry at somebody, what does that say about who you are? Maybe John Cyrus and I should write an honor song for my therapist. And 99 more honor songs for my mother. Your mom was so serious, John texted. Please say something to Junior about his cousin when he gets on stage, she'd say. He will listen to you, she'd say. And I was like, sure, I'll talk to him. Laugh out loud. But I didn't listen to anybody, I texted. I know, but I didn't have the heart to tell her otherwise. You know, you just gotta listen to and respect mothers. She felt better knowing I would talk to you. Wait, I'm older than you, I texted. Why was my mom telling you to be my elder? What would I have said to you, John texted, without laughing? I would have started my talk by repeating what mom had just asked you to say to me. I know, laugh out loud. Maybe that's why I never said anything to you. You know me. Your mom knew you better than everybody else. Later, as I reread my conversation with John, I thought about the ways in which my mother tried to play good mother, bad mother against me. I thought how she often tried to make me obey the Edith Whartonian social rules of the reservation. Respect your elders, even if they're dumb or lazy or asswipes. You can bring crying babies to any and all events and nobody will mind all that much. Don't talk about the felonies, but you can endlessly gossip about the misdemeanors. Make sure you clap for all the powwow dancers and not just your favorite category. Even though you know your tribe is the best, that doesn't mean you're the best of your tribe. You can tell the truth about Indians in private, but don't tell the truth if white people are listening. My mother often disobeyed those rules and many others. I miss her constant rebellion. I miss her inconsistent mothering. I miss her stern and hypocritical judgment. I miss the courtroom inside her heart. I miss Lily and Alexi, my most beloved and failed censor. Chapter 130, Self-Exam. Dear audience, please stand if you were raised by a terrible mother. Okay, approximately half of you. So I'd say that terrible mothers are commonplace, just like terrible fathers. So let's mourn for the children who never knew childhood. Our grief is justified. Our anger is good. I won't blame children for childish scorn. But there comes a day when a broken child becomes an adult. On that day, you'll need to choose between the domestic and wild. You'll need to escalate war or declare peace. I tell you this because I'm the kid, mother stung, who became a terrible adult son. And I'm to blame for that. I made that mess because I am the amateur of forgiveness. Chapter 131. The No. So we must forgive all those who trespass against us. Fuck that shit. I'm not some charitable trust. There are people I will hate even after I'm ashes and dust. Chapter 132. Jungian. Even as I deny the idea of God, the idea of God interrogates me. Even as I pretend that my love for my mother is conflicted, it's my mother who, in my dreams, emerges from a door, marked a door. An image so overtly self-subversive that it drops me, laughing and praying, to the floor. Chapter 133. Side Effects. 10 months after brain surgery, I realized that my unilateral hearing loss had worsened. While I could still hear normally out of my left ear, my impaired right ear seemed to be slightly more damaged. That made it difficult for me to understand speech in crowded and noisy environments. Even when my wife and sons and I talked during a relatively quiet dinner at home, I often missed or misheard words and phrases. A simple sentence like "pass the potatoes" could turn into a mysterious and inexplicable stew of disconnected words. But I also noticed that my brain, rather than accept the blank spots and lines of nonsense, would reach deep into its memory files and pull out a familiar word or phrase as a replacement. My brain was always working hard to make sense out of nonsense. So one day, in a crowded restaurant, when a waiter recited the daily specials to me, I heard him say, "American woman, get away from me," instead of whatever he said about the salad du jour. Yes, in crowded rooms, my confused and hard-working brain works like a jukebox. Or maybe more like the shuffle on an iPod. My brain translates misheard language into song lyrics I know by heart. And like every pop culture addict, I can sing along with hundreds, perhaps thousands of top 40 rock hits. I know my brain contains a vast databank of lyrics, so I laugh at the possibilities. Which songwriter's poetry will I hear the next time a stranger or friend or family member speaks to me in a crowded room? I hope to hear Prince's sexy lyrics more than Air Supply's sappy shit, but I won't be in control of that process. After neurosurgery, I have learned that my brain is a boarding house, where my waking consciousness rents one room with a hot plate and a black and white TV, while the rest of the rooms are occupied by a random assortment of banshees, ghosts, mimes wearing eagle feathers, and approximately 12,000 strangers who look exactly like me. And oh, there's an auditorium in my mind where Hank Williams is always singing. So, if I ever meet you in a crowded airport or bookstore and you say something like, "I love or hate your books, I've been reading or ignoring them for years," I might think you said something like, "I'm so lonesome I could cry." This auditory phenomenon is somewhat scary, but it also feels like a piece of magic. And what's the magic word? It is compensation. Chapter 134. Hydrotherapy. I don't know how to swim. I can't think of a much worse place to be than immersed in water. But I live in a city surrounded by lakes and canals and bays. What can I say? You must bless your enemies, lest they continually defeat you. My mother was terrified of the water, and never learned to swim either. So did I inherit by nature and or nurture my hydrophobia from her. My sisters and brothers can swim from one side of the river to the other. So what happened to me? Well, I was born hydrocephalic and had brain surgery as an infant. So for years, my damaged head throbbed and quaked from any atmospheric pressure, like driving into the mountains or into the valleys. So imagine how much it hurt to be underwater. Imagine how much it hurt to watch my siblings learn to swim, and then to swim freely in the dozens of rivers, streams, lakes, and ponds on our reservation or at some city pool. My father swam too, with a stroke as lazy as he was. But on the shore, always removed from the water, my mother and I sat and watched our family swimming away from us. "Why are you afraid to swim?" I asked her once, and she said something vague about drowning when she was a kid. "You mean you almost drowned?" I said. "No," she said, "I drown, and then I came back." And listen, my mother was a liar. So I don't know how much of this is true, but she never fully entered a body of water, and would only sometimes sit on a dock or shore or poolside and soak her feet. So I wonder, will a person who has drowned or almost drowned always feel like they're drowning, even after they've been saved? Did my mother's continual rages originate in some large or small way from her drowning or near drowning? I don't know. But I remain terrified that I'll die in a plane crash, but not from striking the earth. No, I'm afraid that my plane will plummet into water. I'm terrified that I will drown inside an airplane. And as I say this fear aloud, I laugh and laugh and laugh at death. Hell, when death comes, I'll laugh and say, "Hey, Mr. Death, it's nice to meet you. That sickle makes you look fat." Because you must mock your enemies, lest they defeat you. Because you must bless your enemies, even if they don't bless you. So I bless the water, my provider, and my nemesis. And I bless my mother, who gave birth to me in water, by water, near water, and in honor and fear of water. Chapter 135, My Food Channel. My mother frying bologna. It curls at the edges and rises off the cast iron pan. This is not acceptable. We are poor, But we do not deserve fried bologna that is crispy hot in the middle of its circle, but cool and fleshy around its diameter. Fried means fried. Partially fried means it ain't fried at all. So my mother slices the meat incompletely. 4 cuts from rim halfway to midpoint. Just enough to make the bologna go flat in the pan and cook evenly. This culinary display doesn't take very long. We children, hungry enough to eat everybody's sins, listen to the sizzle, sizzle, and realize. It's one of my mother's love songs. Chapter 136, Triangle of Needs. Too poor in most winters to afford cold weather clothes, I fought snowball battles using old socks for gloves. Doesn't sound so bad, I know. But my jacket was thin cotton, and I also wore Kmart tennis shoes that we called res boots. My cousins had uranium money, so they had warm stuff to wear. I pretended to be okay when we fought for hours in the freeze. I suppose I could have stayed inside, but I was a kid, and like all other kids, I needed to play. And I would keep playing in the midwinter ice until I started to shake uncontrollably. I wonder how often I was close to hypothermia. I wonder how near I fell to dangerously low body temperatures. In December 1974 or 1975, I stumbled through 2 miles of slush and freezing rain and arrived home, only to discover that we'd lost electricity. We had no heat. My mother, wrapped in an old and thin quilt, was constructing a new and thicker quilt. "What happened to the lights?" I asked. "We had no money to pay the bill," she said. "So I need to finish this quilt and sell it to this white woman in Spokane so I can pay the bill and maybe get some tomato soup and Pepsi, too." Shivering, I cried and said, "But I'm cold now." So my mother told me to take off my wet clothes, and then, wearing only underwear, I crawled beneath the old and new quilts, next to my mother's legs, and eventually got warm. And yes, my mother finished and sold that quilt for less than it was worth. But she paid the bill. She moved the goddamned earth and got our electricity back. Chapter 137, Artist Statement. On our first date, my future wife said she'd once broken up with a boyfriend because his favorite song was the Eagles' Desperado. Well, I remembered that my wife had revealed that goofy bit of information to me, but she always insisted that she'd never said it and that it wasn't true. She'd never dated a man like that. And I insisted just as strongly that she had told me about her Eagles-loving former beau and was just retroactively embarrassed by that particular romantic partner. We argued about it for years. Then one evening, my wife and I watched a Seinfeld rerun. "Hey, Elaine," Jerry said, "what happened to that guy?" "Ah," Elaine said, "I dumped him." "Why?" "Because his favorite song is Desperado." I kept staring at the television as my wife stared at me. I had confused my real life with an episode of a classic situation comedy. So yeah, I think you know by now that I am definitely going to conflate shit. Chapter 138 Sonnet with Fabric Softener 1. This is a poem about an epiphany. 2. This is also a poem about folding laundry. 3. It may have been Mark Twain who said, "The coldest winter I ever spent was a summer in San Francisco." 4. I live in Seattle, whose weather is much like San Francisco's. 5. I believe it was Tom Robbins who said, in describing Seattle, "It wasn't really raining, but everything was wet." 6. I say, our laundry room, even in summer, used to be the fucking coldest place south of Alaska. 7. I'm one of those husbands and fathers who love to do laundry, but don't fold the clean clothes with any regularity. This greatly irritates my wife. "You already did the laundry," she often says. "Why can't you go the extra step and fold it?" I never have an answer to that particular question. 8. Marriage is filled with, among many other things, laundry and unanswered questions. 9. For 16 years, my wife and I cleaned and folded, or did not fold, laundry and froze while doing so. 10. And yes, it was a minor annoyance. We weren't risking hypothermia, but why shouldn't one be comfortable in one's home? 11. On a bright note, the cold room truly made us love wrapping ourselves in sheets hot from the dryer. 12. For 16 years, I often thought of wrapping my fresh out of the shower wife in sheets hot from the dryer, but it was too damn cold to be naked anywhere near the laundry room. 13. Then one day, I bought insulated curtains at Target and hung them in all the doorways of the basement where our laundry room is located. This immediately made the laundry room at least 15 degrees warmer. "That's all it took?" my wife asked. "Yes," I said. "Technically speaking, this is called an epiphany." 14. Dear wife, I'm sorry that I am mysteriously incapable of folding clean laundry. But I iron. Oh, I iron. Sweetheart, I'll make your white shirt so crisp and sharp that it will split atoms as you walk. Chapter 139 Complications. In 2016, while traveling to a Journey concert with my wife and older son, my brain crafted a mixtape of ballads. Sad songs about unrequited love, minor chords, one piano key. The silence between notes, the silence between songs on the mixtape. the hiss of absence. "You know," I said to my wife as she drove us along, "I just realized that every Indian boy on my res who ever punched me is dead."